This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
I was working at the Central Intelligence Agency, and I spoke to my boss about the fact that there's a missing chapter in the story of the origin of CIA. I said there's a story about a man of whom nobody seems to know anything.
Although he'd always say, look, my good name's Intrepid. Anywhere you are in the world, if you get locked up or you're in jail or whatever, call me and help will be on the way.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. To the brink of war and back again, but will there ultimately be any let-up in the missile and drone strikes by the US and Israel? On the Iranian forces fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria, or Iranian-led anyway. Will the Iraqi parliament get their way and see US troops leave Iraq? And what are the key facts skipped over or ignored in the West's mass media? Like the Iraqi prime minister's statement that Soleimani, the general who was killed by Trump and his drones, wasn't in Iraq to blow up the US embassy at all, but to broker a peace deal with the Saudis, which could have led to an end, potentially, to the war in Yemen. Something the US and Israel would have been very interested in. And PS752, that's the flight number of the doomed Ukrainian 737, which crashed in Tehran early on Wednesday morning, 4 hours after the Iranian strikes on US bases in Iraq. Plus, the CIA and America's descent into lawlessness. We look at pro-Nazi US statesman Nelson Rockefeller. His deal to get the votes Ben-Gurion needed for the UN to recognise the Israeli state back in 1948. The deal was to keep your mouth shut about all the Nazis now working in US intelligence. You can have a country or you can have vengeance, but not both, said Nelson Rockefeller. An exclusive tonight with FBI lawyer and special investigator, author of The Secret War Against the Jews, John Loftus. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at Tuesday at noon. This week, journalist Neil Clark, former writer for the Daily Express and Daily Mail, now no longer able to get his articles into UK national papers, but he is published on RT, the Russian channel, on their website. He's done one of the best articles, I think, on the Corbyn defeat. It's called Destroyed by Appeasing His Enemies, the Shakespearean Tragedy of Jeremy Corbyn. Neil talks about how journalists like him, who break taboos, are being stalked online and elsewhere, also put under surveillance. We also have Abs Ali. He describes his intolerable homeless Bristol hostel life here in Bristol. But he's not just moaning. He explains how the housing crisis could and should be fixed. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday to that, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we first speak to Saeed Mohsin Abbas. I think it's just Saeed Abbas, actually, isn't it, who's joining us on the line. Hi, Saeed.
Hi there.
Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, an introduction as to your background in journalism? I think you were originally born in Pakistan, now working in London.
Yes, I was trained at the BBC. Nominally, I was worked for Channel 4 as a documentary producer for many years. And then I gravitated towards, global media channels, various Middle Eastern media channels is who I do a lot of political commentary for, as well as making various reports and documentaries. So that's the field of Middle Eastern politics is my main area.
Now, can you just give us your view of the context of the presence of the US troops in Iraq right now? Because that's obviously what's the bone of contention, is the Iraqi parliament this week just simply saying, no, we want them out. Well, what are they doing there?
The Americans are there primarily to protect their oil interests. It's claimed that up to 50% of Iraqi oil ends up in American coffers one way or another. They're there to offer, I think, security protection for the likes of ExxonMobil and the various other transnational oil companies which need to do business in Iraq, which has one of the largest reserves of oil in the world. So it's primarily about oil, but the secondary interest is that Israel has a massive interest in making sure that the Middle East remains balkanized and doesn't, in a way, unify to threaten its existence. That's their version of things. But in reality, what that boils down to is the United States rolling out a military set of camps and bases in the area to effectively keep the locals, the natives, under control for these two objectives, to siphon oil and resources and to make sure that Israel maintains its geopolitical, if you like, influence and control on the Arab world.
But there is, obviously, within Israel, a very great nervousness about being surrounded by these hostile Arab nations. It's almost like they are just isolated there.
Well, they certainly are surrounded, but they have 400 nuclear weapons. No Arab nation has nuclear weapons. So a nation sitting there with 400 nuclear weapons at its disposal and then claiming to be the victim, arguably also getting $3.5 billion of military hardware and supplies and ammunition and whatnot from the United States on a yearly basis. That's their annual income from the American coffers, doesn't really have a lot to worry about militarily. What ought to be worrying about really is, first of all, coming up with a genuine plan of justice for all of their civilians, all the population that lives in and around Israel and Palestine. And that's what they're not doing. So actually what they've done is they've dug their own hole by effectively mistreating their own citizens, basically robbing them of their homes and treating them as second-class citizens, building an apartheid system. And as a result, of course, the Arab world is not going to be happy. In fact, most of the Arab countries that surround Israel are very friendly to it. Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt are all friends of Israel. They're, in fact, in cahoots and allied to them. It's the resistance axis which has emerged over the last, say, 30 to 40 years, which has a military, if like, commitment to defending what they would say is the oppressed people of the Arab world, the ordinary folk who've been oppressed by Zionist and American imperialist policies in the region. They're the kind of Arabs and the kind of locals that the Israelis actually are afraid of and don't like. They're actually quite pally with a lot of what I would describe as Zionist Arabs. That's the Saudi Arabian family of Saud, the Bahraini Khalifa family, the Kuwaiti emirs, and even the Jordanian government. None of them are unfriendly. Even the dictator Sisi in Egypt is a good friend of Israel's.
So let's look at how this latest problem arose. I mean, we're talking really here about the attacks on the American air bases in Iraq, and previous to that, the assassination of Soleimani, which just took place, the Iranian general, just about a week ago, just over a week ago. But before all that, there was things going on, weren't there? But Friday, the 27th of December, I noticed that the Popular Mobilization Force, which is this militia group which is apparently backed by the Iranians in Iraq, they attacked something called the US K-1 military base in Kirkuk and killed an Iraqi-born guy, though apparently he's now a naturalized American, but he was born in Iraq. He's a translator, Norez Hamid, who worked for Valiant Integrated Services. Now, could you just maybe put into context, this is just one person killed. I mean, we shouldn't say just, should we? I mean, anybody killed, of course, is a sad event. But this seems to have sparked this whole set of circumstances off. So what do you think these translators, these bases, US K-1 military base in Kirkuk is up to?
Well, Norris Hamid, I think, who was the Valiant Integrated Services operative who was killed. First of all, it's not been proven who killed him. nobody officially took responsibility of that killing. We don't know even to this day, because Iraqi troops or soldiers or police also got killed, I think, on that base. It's not clear who killed him, actually. Nobody's taken official responsibility. So number one, there was no evidence to actually confirm who killed him. This is simply the Americans who said, yes, it's the people of Kataib Hezbollah or the people who were from the PMUs who'd done it. And that became the pretext for what in a way unfolded later. But actually, we ought to take a step further back, because these black operations or psychological operations or color revolutions that have been popping up in Iraq and the instability and the terror attacks are all linked ultimately to forces that don't want Iraq to become a stable, if you like, nation, a sovereign nation which is functional. And that's a big question mark, because the Americans' reason for being there, their official reason, is not oil or anything such thing, that they're supposed to be there helping Iraq to build its infrastructure, to stabilize it as a democracy, and to basically bring back peace after two invasions by the Americans themselves, you know, rightly or wrongly. Anyhow, the bottom line is, in that context, what you also have to understand is that Iraq is along the Belt Road Initiative. And I'd like to bring in the incident that happened in September, which was very significant, and I think is probably the major trigger for what's gone on in the last 2 weeks or so. And that is that China signed a deal with Iraq of around $250 billion of infrastructure building in Iraq. Now, Adil Abdelmehdi, the prime minister of Iraq, agreed that deal. The Americans were awfully upset about that, because the Americans don't want the Chinese to come in. They feel that this is their preserve. So actually, that deal, combined with stirrings that the Russians will give the Iraqis S-400s.
This is the S-400s, this Russian surface-to-air missile.
Yes, right. That's their defense mechanism, which Turkey and Erdogan have also taken up, which NATO is very upset about. So actually, this brings in American rivalries with China and with Russia, economic and military and geopolitical. So the question of Iraq is not just limited to Iran and its involvement.
No, although of course Iran not. Well, it's fascinating what you're saying, because it's almost as if there's a kind of tug of war going on here between the two main superpowers, the US and China, over Iraq, or at least it's starting. Martin, I know you wanted to come in on that. Martin Summers.
Yeah, thanks for your analysis. I've just what I've been picking up is that Abdelmahdi, who was the prime minister of Iraq, he said obviously that Soleimani was coming to meet him to talk about a negotiation with the Saudis, and he also said, as I understand it, that he was when he did this deal with the Chinese to build up the oil infrastructure inside Iraq, Trump phoned him and said, "Don't do this, otherwise there's going to be there's going to be demonstrations against you, and also we were going to use snipers which will kill the demonstrators and police officers." And he said all of this in the Iraqi Parliament last week, and that is now circulating out there. So in other words, and Trump basically threatened him, and he's not very happy about it, from what I understand.
Well, that's, I imagine, been reported much more in the Iraqi media than it is over here, because it hasn't been reported at all over here. So anyway, we started off with this incident up in Kirkuk with this contractor being killed, who was an Iraqi-born guy. And then that was just the day after Boxing Day. And then on Sunday, the 29th of December, a US airstrike killed 25 and injured 51 at five popular mobilization force facilities all over Iraq. So that's 25 killed plus 51 injured by US airstrikes, and then by missile and drone strikes and airstrikes. On Tuesday the 31st of December, that's New Year's Eve, the US embassy was besieged in Baghdad, and although it wasn't reported over here, the US ambassador and team were reported in the Middle East to have left Baghdad, basically. So that was it. They were saying, "We're not hanging around here anymore because the embassy's been besieged." And it looks as if the Iraqi security forces actually let the popular mobilization forces into the green zone in order to get in there. So that was, it looks as if the Iraqis are basically allowing the popular mobilization force a bit more free rein because of all these airstrikes which have been going on their territory by the US. So then on Friday the 3rd of Jan, that's this time last week, just after midnight, Soleimani plus three Iraqis were assassinated. Claim that he was planning to blow up the US embassy. And that was the claim. Anyway, Saeed.
Well, I think just a little context. I mean, it's a very, very interesting chronology there, which actually unveils a lot. Because, first of all, you have to address the issue of the relationship between what are called the popular mobilization units of Iraq, the military force which was which rose up on the fatwa of Grand Ayatollah Sistani, the most influential religious figure in Iraq. 130,000 or so Iraqis were conscripts, and what their purpose was to defeat ISIS, which had invaded Mosul and occupied large swathes of Iraq. This is the popular mobilization unit. They're made up of lots of different affiliations and leaderships there. Many of them are Shia, many of them are Christian, many of them are Sunnis as well.
It sounds to me what you're saying, what you're talking about here, Saeed, is a kind of mission creep. So they started off attacking ISIS, and now they're starting to attack US bases instead.
Well, the reality is that the first question we've addressed is why the Americans at that time did nothing about ISIS. They had air control of Iraq. They did nothing to destroy those Humvees driving down open desert roads to overrun Iraq. It was the PMU forces which actually came in. And I think what the reality is that the Americans, there's a strong allegation, and it's more than strong, to be honest, because even in WikiLeaks and with Hillary Clinton being exposed as having said that actually we allowed ISIS to develop and we are the ones, the Americans, who actually wanted them to come and create chaos in the region. This is a huge, huge area that needs to be uncovered. But the PMUs dashed any plans of an Islamic State sponsored by Israel or America emerging in Iraq.
Now, hang on a minute, because Donald Trump claims that the US and his forces were the ones that stopped ISIS.
Well, this is what the US did was, when they saw these forces were not going to succeed, of course they camped up in the Kurdistan, because the Kurdish territory in Iraq is very prone to the American, if you like, affiliation and support. They actually made out that they were doing, because actually they didn't want either the Syrians or Iraqis to totally wipe out these ISIS guys. In fact, there's an allegation, very clear allegation, that the Americans have shielded by keeping air cover, by controlling the territory up to the Euphrates themselves. They stopped the Russians and the Syrians and the Iranians effectively wiping out ISIS altogether. In fact, many of them were airlifted out, it's said, and are still based at the Al-Tanf US base and being trained up for another incursion. This is the real worry, and this is linked to the attacks which the Israelis as well as the Americans carried out on Kataib Hezbollah. They did it on the borders of the Syrian and Iraqi transit point, where most of the supplies from Iraq to Syria would get, or Iran to Syria.
Okay, well, look, I'm going to get back onto our timeline now. We just mentioned the assassination of General Soleimani. This time, we couldn't quite bring it last week because he said it after our show had finished. But here's Donald Trump announcing the assassination of Soleimani, although he doesn't use the word assassination. And maybe we can discuss afterwards whether that's what it was or not.
As president, my highest and most solemn duty is the defense of our nation and its citizens. Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani. Soleimani was plotting imminent and sinister attacks on American diplomats and military personnel, but we caught him in the act and terminated him. Under my leadership, America's policy is unambiguous to terrorists who harm or intend to harm any American. We will find you. We will eliminate you. We will always protect our diplomats, service members, all Americans, and our allies. For years, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and its ruthless Quds force under Soleimani's leadership has targeted, injured, and murdered hundreds of American civilians and servicemen. The recent attacks on U.S. targets in Iraq, including rocket strikes that killed an American and injured four American servicemen very badly, as well as a violent assault on our embassy in Baghdad, were carried out at the direction of Soleimani. Soleimani made the death of innocent people his sick passion, contributing to terrorist plots as far away as New Delhi and London, Today we remember and honor the victims of Soleimani's many atrocities, and we take comfort in knowing that his reign of terror is over. Soleimani has been perpetrating acts of terror to destabilize the Middle East for the last 20 years. What the United States did yesterday should have been done long ago. A lot of lives would have been saved. Just recently, Soleimani led the brutal repression of protesters in Iran, where more than 1,000 innocent civilians were tortured and killed by their own government. We took action last night to stop a war. We did not take action to start a war.
Well, luckily it didn't start a war, but that may be a little bit, it's only luck, because the assassination, Martin Summers, of a senior general in Iran is unprecedented, this sort of thing. And if we were to look upon it as a quid pro quo, it would mean the Iranians should have the right to assassinate maybe the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States, Mike Milley. I don't think the Americans would like that very much.
No, they wouldn't. But in actual fact, all that bluster is covering up the fact that there is no legal basis for this in international law whatsoever. When Gavril Princip killed Archduke Ferdinand many years ago, he had some kind of support from the Serbian military intelligence. But basically, he was acting as a lone spark for potentially a world war. And now we've got the President of the United States who thinks he can go around assassinating other people's top military personnel and claim that that's legal. It's not legal. It's illegal. It's illegal under the US Constitution, because, of course, Congress is the only people who can decide to have a war. But, of course, that's all been bypassed years ago, and Trump basically is a gangster. That's all he is.
Saeed, what about this claim that there was going to be an attack on the US embassy, and that's why the Americans had to protect themselves?
Qasem Soleimani was on a diplomatic mission. Adel Abdel Mahdi has confirmed this time and time again. Now the Americans want to wash that over. He came on the request a request of the Saudis to negotiate a sort of a rapprochement in the Middle East. The Americans were aware of this. Qasem Soleimani was using normal, ordinary mobile phones. He wasn't a covert operative who was skulking around. It was a normal airline that he came on. He had his mobile switched on. He was there on the invitation of Adel Abdel Mahdi on a diplomatic mission. So what the Americans did was they carried out an extrajudicial killing, targeted killing, based on a desire for really fomenting trouble, provoking Iran into some kind of action and war. And the reality is that they did it on the behest of Israel, who actually is the primary factor that wants war in that region.
Well, have any evidence for Israel's involvement?
Well, at the moment, Mossad, number one, has been clearly involved in the Iraq situation. They've been knocking out these popular mobilization units themselves directly. We know of at least three incidents there. The Mossad agency works hand in glove with the CIA. Let's not, dance around the tune. Everything that Mossad does and CIA do is known to each other. They're hand-in-glove partners within that Middle East scenario. There's nothing they don't know. In fact, Netanyahu is the one who's been beating the drums for war, but you will notice how quiet the Israelis went when the Iranians actually started firing missiles. So Israel wants America to do its dirty work, but it doesn't want the impact on Tel Aviv Haifa.
Let's have a look now at what happened the day after the assassination of Soleimani, which was a Saturday, the 4th of January. Donald Trump threatened to hit 52 Iranian sites, including UNESCO cultural sites. But Martin, at the same time, it was put out in Iraq by the Prime Minister that actually they've been on some sort of a mission to do with Saudi Arabia. You mentioned that briefly earlier, that it could be that Soleimani was actually over there to broker some sort of peace deal rather than to blow up the US embassy.
Well, I think the idea he's going to blow up the US embassy is absolutely bluster and ridiculous. Soleimani basically operated openly because he presumed that they wouldn't be stupid enough to kill him because he's actually, as has been pointed out, acting as a diplomat.
One of the things I've heard that Soleimani and this Saudi peace mission was actually an initiative of the United States, if that's possible, that they had brought Soleimani over to Iraq.
Well, that's what the Iraqi Prime Minister is saying, is that he was asked by the Americans to arrange the meeting and to get things going.
Now that reminds me of 1990 and April Glasby saying to Saddam Hussein, well, it's okay, you can invade Kuwait, we don't mind, obviously they're stealing your oil, go for it. So a kind of entrapment potentially.
It is,
Saeed, what do you make of this? Do you think this it's okay to potentially correct to compare it to the entrapment that caused the first Gulf War in 1990?
It's a very good analogy, and I think it's something which we have to recognize, that the American and the Israeli psychological operations units are highly sophisticated and they're constantly working. And these kinds of traps are constantly laid. The truth is that the Israeli and American intelligence will also know that the IRGC and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, etc., have a very sophisticated and very wide-ranging, infrastructure for being able to carry operations out themselves. So killing General Qasem Soleimani, who's by now trained dozens and dozens of military strategists who will follow his tactics and whatever his kind of operations are. By killing Qasem Soleimani alone, it wasn't really going to stop the Islamic Republic of Iran and its geostrategic operations in that region by any means. It's quite clearly was designed to get the Iranians to fall for the trap of a full-out war, and then that would have justified presumably.
Okay, so what you're saying, this is a kind of a provocation. It wasn't really reported much because there was so much else going on. On Saturday, 5 were killed in an Israeli attack on the Popular Mobilization Force at Taj Stadium in Baghdad on that Saturday, the same Saturday that Trump threatened to destroy the UNESCO cultural site, even though he says he doesn't want to start a war. Then on Monday, that's this Monday, on 6th of January, the Iraqi parliament voted for US forces to leave Iraq. On Tuesday, then we had the al-Assad and airbuilt US air bases were hit by 20 Iranian missiles. Now, this is it's quite important, the timing, because of the air crash as well. That's 22:30 Greenwich Mean Time on Tuesday, the attacks on the air bases. This is the reprisal by the Iranians. But then probably the most surprising of all the incidents so far is on Wednesday at 2:45 in the morning Greenwich Mean Time, Ukraine Airlines PS752 737 crashes in Tehran. What do you make of the air crash, Saeed?
Well, it's very convenient. I think it's, first of all, any air crash when it happens, there are procedures that need to be followed. There are international aviation procedures. Iran has complied with those. It's actually invited in the people that are relevant, the experts, including Americans and others. But before they've even had a chance to really get the investigation going, what we've suddenly had is this opportunistic psychological operation, which has begun utilizing the Canadian head of state, and also the Americans and the British have jumped in as well. There's suddenly, before any evidence, before any real facts can be established, what you've got is these allegations. And this is the way modern media works. They know how to play it. If you put a word out there to say that missile's been detected without any real evidence, without presenting any evidence, as soon as you put that word out, it will go viral, and everywhere people will have this sense of something happening. This is a psychological operation methodology for putting Iran under further pressure. Now, we don't know what happened, whether it was engine failure or an explosion happened inside that plane, or whether it just whether there was a surface-to-air missile launched by an MKO terrorist sponsored by the Americans in Iran, or whether it was an Iranian missile that misfired. It could be any of these. It could be millions of other things. The bottom line is we don't know.
Martin Summers, can I just bring you in? Because I know you were saying that there were potentially passengers that didn't get on the plane, but their luggage was on the plane. And that the plane was delayed?
The plane was definitely delayed. I mean, obviously, everybody's looking at what's happening in an incident like that. I'd just like to say what's been said, that this is a psychological warfare operation, possibly one of just an opportunistic jumping on the bandwagon. But as you say, if it was a surface-to-air missile, possibly by somebody from MEK, the terrorists who are fighting the Iranian government, they're very much in cahoots with the Israelis and the Western powers, and it'd be quite straightforward. for them to take somebody out there with a man pad and take the plane
down. I mean, one of the most interesting things, of course, is the video of the aircraft, which has been shared widely online and used by all the main news agencies. I'm no absolute expert, and of course, videos can easily be forged, but it did look to me as if the reason that the person was filming it with their mobile phone was because the plane was already on fire, and then we had a big explosion. Because, I mean, you don't just film planes as they go over in the middle of the night. I mean, that's certainly not something that people would normally do, Side, is it?
No, I mean, it does all seem very convenient. And of course, let's not forget the Ukrainians have had an incident like this with the previous crash, and the Russians were pinned with that. And it's been something they've used constantly to try and leave in the minds of certainly the Western public that the Russians are some kind of, black ops.
Well, I'm really glad killers. You mentioned the Russians, because one of the first people in the world to say, well, this looks as if this aircraft has been shot down by Russian missiles were the Ukrainians, the very same people, of course, who were involved in the investigation of MH17, which was shot down over Ukraine. And that was announced on the BBC by Jonah Fisher yesterday. That's Thursday morning, literally an hour after the press conference. So let's have a listen now to the BBC World Service's reporter, Jonah Fisher from Ukraine, who, by the way, I criticised, and he blocked me on Twitter. I criticised him about 6-8 months ago, because he actually tweeted that Russia was effectively at war with Ukraine, which I just thought was a ridiculous thing for a senior journalist like him to tweet. But anyhow, he's blocked me. But let's have a listen now to Jonah Fisher and his report of what the Ukrainians had to say about the crash of the Ukrainian airliner in Tehran on Wednesday.
Look, I think we're in a situation where a few hours ago, opinion was rather coming to some sort of consensus that technical failure was almost certainly the cause of this plane crash, particularly in the light of what the Iranians said in their preliminary investigation and the information they came out. That has rather been blown out of the water in the last hour or so. We've had what is, to be quite frank, a pretty astounding statement from one of the key security officials here in Kiev, a man called Alexei Danilov. He has representatives in Tehran at the moment as part of that investigation team. And he has basically laid out on social media a selection of the different scenarios which the Ukrainian investigators want to look at. And if I can just run them through for you, they're pretty, let's say, explosive in what they want to look at. They firstly want to look at whether there was a missile attack on the plane, possibly a Russian missile attack. Secondly, the possibility of a drone strike. Thirdly, the possibility of a terrorist attack on the plane. And fourthly, the idea of some sort of engine failure or a technical failure. So from a position where on the encouragement of Ukraine's president, things seemed to be calming down, and I think people were inclined to accept what the Iranians are saying, we now have a situation where certain security officials are pushing very hard and pushing quite hard the narrative that something might have been nefarious here. There might have been some sort of shoot down. It's not as simple, perhaps, as it might have seemed a few hours ago.
So that's Jonah Fisher there on the World Service. Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, as I said on
coming from Ukraine,
particularly. Well, as I said on RT this afternoon, I think Zelensky's position was that, as far as he was concerned, we're going to wait for the investigation. And you've got to remember that Zelensky's in quite a weak position. He's quite strong politically in Ukraine now because he was the peace candidate. But of course, there are forces inside his own security forces who are very, very close to the Americans and the Israelis, and they seem to be contradicting him. I smell a rat. Basically,
well, I mean, the track of the aircraft, which has been circulated widely, used in the newspapers, etc., does stop abruptly. But the thing, of course, that's the track which is being tracked from the aircraft's electronics, the avionics, the transponders, which would have broke if there was a fire, would probably almost certainly have switched off immediately. And the idea that there's no distress call when you haven't got the ability to communicate, or when you're struggling to try and keep the airliner up in the air, that's not. I would like to see it. It'd be interesting to see the radar track. face. But anyway, look, what's your conclusion? Can you just conclude on what you make of all of this? Because we've also seen, literally today, this morning, the Israelis now continuing these attacks on the popular mobilization forces. They've killed six people on the Syrian-Iraq border. So no let up on these drone strikes and missile strikes in other people's territory by Israel and the US.
Well, I think the asymmetric war in the Middle East is going to continue. I think that the popular mobilization units, the Yemeni Ansarullah, the Hezbollah in Lebanon, in Syria, all of the resistance axis forces, I think they're going to be even more committed to eradicating U.S. bases and the U.S. military from the Middle East. That's an absolute given. So we've got an ongoing certain asymmetric war on. I think on the other side of it, Israel, of course, is in no real position to go into a formal head-on war with this axis, and I don't think that's going to happen. The Americans could initiate further false flag operations to give them the excuse to come in and do it. But you see, the problem is a war with Iran head-on would mean basically economic disaster for the world. All the Iranians have to do is mine the Hormuz, destroy the opportunity for any oil to come out of there, and you've got economic meltdown globally. That means the whole world is interested in this, and ultimately one hopes that the world will see sense and try to rein in the Americans not to do the unthinkable.
Okay, Said Abbas, thanks very much for joining us. Now, Martin, I think what we'll do now is we'll have a listen to an exclusive interview I did, which really is looking at the CIA and America's descent into lawlessness. We're going to go now to look at pro-Nazi US statesman Nelson Rockefeller and his deal to get the votes that David Ben-Gurion needed for the UN to recognize the Israeli state back in 1948. The deal? Well, John Loftus, the FBI special investigator, will tell us all about it.
My name is John Loftus, and back in 1977, I was hired by the Attorney General of the United States, and for the next 4 years, I worked in Washington during the Carter and Reagan administrations and received virtually every top secret and above classification there is. Now, for example, I had a cosmic clearance for access to all NATO top secrets, a Q clearance for nuclear weapons, an SCI clearance for wiretaps by GCHQ and the NSA. So I was very well rated. For about 2 years, I had unlimited access to read any classified file I wished.
So what was the purpose, John?
Well, it's twofold. I wanted to be the Justice Department's lawyer to handle classified cases for nuclear, biological, chemical stuff. And then I was assigned to do this Nazi war crime stuff. Well, it turns out a lot of the Nazis I was supposed to prosecute were on the intelligence payroll, but we didn't know it, because the British Secret Service had dumped them here after World War II. And they said, look, these guys aren't really Nazis. They only fought with the Germans because they hate the Russians more. They're really Eastern European freedom fighters. Well, the joke was on us, because the British liaison at the time was Kim Philby. And there were five communist double agents inside the Secret Service itself. So instead of getting freedom fighters, we got Nazi war criminals, people that the Russians could blackmail into betraying American secrets. And they did. They sold us out. It was all hushed up for 4 years until I was stupid enough to stumble across the secret records in the underground archives.
Can you give us an idea of some of the secrets that were betrayed in that way?
Well, for example, there was a discussion about having a NATO intelligence service. West German intelligence officer was going to head it. And he turned out to be a guy by the name of Felfa. He was General Galen's right-hand man. But Felfa was a communist double agent. And I talked to a guy in the Pentagon who briefed him. He said, John, we gave Felfa everything in the cupboard. There were no secrets he did not have. So, yeah, we lost everything. For a while, there was actually a debate within CIA whether they should just, close up shop and admit that they've been penetrated.
Incredible. Anyway, one of the things that I found fascinating in your book, The Secret War Against the Jews, because, you know, you were obviously looking at some of the intimate negotiations at the end of the Second World War about the creation of the State of Israel. I mean, obviously that state then has gone on through the 67 war to break all sorts of UN resolutions. But let's get back to that moment in 1948. When the State of Israel was first created, because as I understand it, it was by no means certain that the UN was actually going to vote to agree to recognize Israel.
No, I mean, the vote was 25 to 13, 3 days before the final vote. And that was four votes short of the two-thirds majority needed to approve the official petition of Palestine and create the State of Israel. And so the Israelis knew if they didn't do something, the Zionists rather knew, if they didn't do something radical in 3 days, that they would not have a nation. And within those 3 days, they turned the votes around and they picked up eight more votes. So the final vote was 33 to 13. So it was an astounding turnaround. And the Arabs were furious and the British were furious because they felt that this was just going to mess up Britain's relations with the Arabs and their oil interests. And the American oil men agreed with the British. They wanted to sabotage President Truman as well. And so the Israelis outfoxed them, and one of the ways they did it was they had something that Stalin wanted very badly, which was silence about the MAX network, which was the big Russian intelligence secret during World War II, where they had double agents inside Hitler's intelligence service. And Stalin wanted to sell those MAX agents over to the gullible Americans. So he said he would give all three votes. Russia had three votes in the UN, one for Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. He would give three votes for Israel. And then the guy they really nailed, though, was Nelson Rockefeller, because there were, I think, some nine nations in Latin America that were, quite frankly, pro-fascist during the war. Nelson was the intelligence chief in charge of Latin America during World War II at his own suggestion.
Hang on, John, because he's from a very powerful family, isn't he? Standard Oil and John D. Rockefeller were an enormously powerful force in the U.S. economy.
Not just in the U.S. economy, in the world economy. The Rockefellers were linked with the British firm Brown Brothers for investment. And in the 20s and 30s, they just dominated investment in Nazi Germany. And so some of the finest families in the United Kingdom and the United States were making a lot of money off Hitler's rise to power. So they literally funded the Third Reich. Now, once war began, of course, that was treason. And, you know, things had to be handled rather delicately.
We probably should look at some of the potential reasons why they felt that Hitler was such an important person to fund, because they were very concerned, weren't they, about the build-up of the Bolsheviks and the Soviet Union, and they saw Hitler as a kind of buttress against that.
Yeah, he was going to be not just a buttress against the Russians, but they saw Hitler as a dog in a leash that could keep the labor unions in line in Germany and keep the communist agitators out. This was the deal that was sold to them by Hitler's finance minister, Helmut Jacht, who was actually born in Brooklyn in the United States. So he knew the Dulles brothers and the key lawyers for the Wall Street bankers, and convinced them that Nazi Germany was a great place to put your money. And they did.
And let's get back to Nelson Rockefeller and his role in the creation of the State of Israel.
Yep. The Israelis had a source. I didn't put this in the book, but the Dulles brothers' sister, Eleanor Dulles, was the one who stole some critical documents called the Safe Haven Index. And it was something we made during World War II with British help where we intercepted, you know, Nazi codes and cables. And we found out which nations in Latin America were getting protection to help Nazi money and then trading back with Nazi Germany. So Eleanor stole the files and gave them to the Zionists. She had a reason. She had been married to a Jewish guy whom her brothers hated. They sort of forced him to commit suicide, and she had a child who was Jewish. So she wanted to do whatever she could to secretly help the Zionists. She knew that her brothers were on Hitler's side. There's no other way to put it. They really were. And that Rockefeller was. He was making a great deal of money off this. Rockefeller's hope was that America would stay neutral in the war and we'd make money selling weapons to both sides while they all beat themselves to death. Then we'd pick up the pieces. So Rockefeller was in charge of all Latin American operations. So the Zionists had him to, once they had the safe haven index, they had Rockefeller cold. You know, they knew exactly how the Nazis had brought money in, to which countries during World War II, and how Rockefeller had protected them. Rockefeller even leased one of his intelligence headquarters in Venezuela from a Nazi. It was treason. It was giving aid and comfort to the enemy in time of war. So Rockefeller was in deep trouble. So the Zionists walked in and dropped their copy of the Safe Haven Index on his table. And, you know, Rockefeller knew he was caught, but he wanted a trade. He said, look, you know, I'll get the extra votes you need to partition into an Arab and a Jewish state. But in return, you have to keep quiet about all the Nazis and the Nazi money going to South America. And they cut the deal. Rockefeller said, I think it was, you can have vengeance or you can have a nation, but you can't have both.
And I suppose it was David Ben-Gurion at the time that had to make that decision.
Yeah, yeah. And I talked to one of the guys who was actually there. It was not in Rockefeller's office, but he was an aide to Reuven Shiloah, who was the head of the pre-Mossad spy service. And he knew about this. He visited me as an old guy in the 80s.
Hang on, because I think he was the first official head of Mossad once the Israeli state had been recognized.
Yes, yes. But before there was an Israel, there was this organization that Shiloah ran, and this guy was part of it. And he was fully aware of the blackmail against Rockefeller. But, you know, what choice did Ben-Gurion have? You know, it was a tiny group of, you know, Holocaust survivors and settlers surrounded by, you know, hundreds of millions of Arabs. The British were selling all the guns they could to the Arabs and telling the Americans that we couldn't send any weapons to the Jews. It was setting them up for a second Holocaust.
I mean, surely there was nothing to stop the new Israeli state, Ben-Gurion and the rest, actually welching on the deal. Once they got their country, they could then go hell for leather after these Nazi war criminals if they wanted.
Well, a dozen years later they did, you know, but they went after Eichmann. But at that point, Rockefeller was dead and Nixon was president. He was someone that they truly feared. That was the exception to the rule. They went and got Eichmann. From the time of the vote, for the next 12 years, when Ben-Gurion was president or defense minister, there was no Israeli list of wanted Nazis, there was no Israeli assigned to hunt Nazis, and there was no arrest or trials of Nazis in Israel.
And I know when the Mossad...
They kept their bargain.
When the Mossad chief got Eichmann, that's Issa Harel, once he brought him back to Israel, he was then quietly retired.
Yeah, but the thing is that it wasn't the Israelis who broke the deal, it was Nixon. Okay? So Nixon had decided that the Nazis who were hiding out in America were the Republican Party's answer to the Jewish vote for the Democrats. And we found some astonishing documents where our State Department briefed the Australians that, oh yeah, we know where these Eastern European Nazis are in America, but they're important to get out the ethnic vote in five key states. Pretty cynical stuff.
You title your book "The War Against the Jews." I mean, in what way do you think the Zionists were, in some ways, working against the ordinary interests of ordinary Jews? Because it doesn't seem as if always that the two are aligned.
Oh no, God! There were terrible disagreements. Rabbi Silver, one of the Zionist leaders in America, was constantly beating up on President Truman for his support for a Jewish state. And there was some of the conservative Zionists. I remember reading a top secret document about who was the head of the Irgun, really bloodthirsty guy. And he said, you know, this stuff about the Holocaust has to be nonsense. You know, Hitler would never get rid of his most intelligent leaders and manufacturers. So there were, you know, extremists on both sides of the issue who were, you know, Zionists as well as, you know, not saying that it was just the Republican Party. There were the people in Truman's cabinet, like Forrestal, who were very opposed to this having the state of Israel. And it was Forrestal who was leaking all the Truman secret documents to embarrass him. There was a CIA assessment that if Israel ever became a nation, it would be a communist puppet state within 3 years. And that was passed around.
What about the role of the Dulles brothers in the late 40s and early 50s?
They were animals. Their goal was to enrich their clients. After their candidate Dewey was defeated by Truman in 48, they went out and recruited General Eisenhower, made him president of Columbia University, and prepped him to run for president. So he was their front man.
Mr. Dulles, the CIA has been known as a super-secret organization. Do you think that's the way it should be?
I don't think that's the way it is. There's no intelligence service in the world that tells as much and talks as much and gives as much to the Congress as does the CIA.
Well, Congressman Lindsay has criticized the CIA as butting into foreign policy. Would you say that is correct?
I have high regard for Congressman Lindsay, but I disagree with him thoroughly in that respect. We appear before the CIA appears before congressional committees and gives them full briefings on what it does.
Congressman Lindsay has suggested that a joint committee of intelligence be formed to replace the CIA. What do you think of that?
No, not to replace the CIA, but to review the CIA and to watch it. That's up to the Congress, I think, and the President.
What would you say could be done to eliminate the gaps in intelligence such as occurred at Cuba and the Berlin Wall and so on?
Well, all you can do is to try to improve in every way possible. Of course, the public often thinks there are gaps when there aren't really gaps, because we can't tell the public beforehand what we know about what's going to happen. But when something happens that isn't known to the press beforehand, they rather assume that the CIA didn't know it either. That's not always the case.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fisher.
You know, Eisenhower finally spoke out against them with his warning just before he left office about the dangers of the military-industrial complex.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
But basically, Eisenhower turned over foreign policy to the Dulles brothers. One became head of CIA, one became head of the State Department, and they did nothing but fund every dictator around the world who would make a deal for American businessmen.
I mean, was there anything in the Dulles brothers' history that should have warned Eisenhower or anyone else what they were up to?
The Dulles brothers were wiretapped by the British before America's entry into World War II, showing that the Dulles brothers were actively helping the Nazis. John Foster Dulles, for example, was on the board of IG Farben. They had negotiated a stock swap with the Rockefeller Standard Oil. So next to the Rockefellers, this Nazi company, IG Farben, was the second largest shareholder. So there was, you know, a cross-investment going on. So the Dulles brothers were traitors. They were giving aid and comfort to the enemy in time of war. But they represented some of the more powerful families of Wall Street, what they used to call the robber barons. And it's sad to say what happened. You know, 99% of Americans, you know, thought Hitler was a bad guy. 1% thought that he was a moneymaker.
What about the British, though? Because there were quite a lot of pro-Nazis in the UK, not least of which the former king, Edward VIII. I wonder if you came across any documents that throw light upon some of the Hitler's supporters in Britain.
Oh, I did. That's why one of my books, The Secret War Against the Jews, would never be touched by a British publisher, because it told the truth. I read Windsor's file.
This is Windsor Castle. His Royal Highness Prince Edward.
You must believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do without the help and support of the woman I love. And I want you to know that the decision I have made has been mine and mine alone. Ever since I was Prince of Wales, and later on when I occupied the throne, I have been treated with the greatest kindness by all classes of the people, wherever I have lived or journeyed throughout the empire. For that, I am very grateful. I now quit altogether public affairs, and I lay down my burden. It may be some time before I return to my native land, but I shall always follow the fortunes of the British race and empire with profound interest. And if, at any time in the future, I can be found of service to His Majesty, I shall not fail.
He did not resign to marry the woman he loved. He resigned because he was wiretapped by British intelligence of having private communications with Hitler's ambassador to London and Ribbentrop. Windsor was saying, look, we're not going to interfere with Germany's plans to take over the Alsace problem. We're not going to interfere with the Jews or anything else. So, you know, contrary to British law, this guy was making foreign policy of a secret alliance with Hitler. Now, he did this because his mistress, later his wife, was a Nazi intelligence agent. Now, when J. Edgar Hoover wrote to President Roosevelt saying, look, Windsor has to, it's not enough when Windsor was forced to abdicate. Hoover wanted him imprisoned because he was a dangerous Nazi agent. And Churchill said, no, please don't do that, because we have other members of the royal family who are involved and many members of the British establishment. Let's just keep a lid on this. So they put him down in the Bahamas the duration of the war. But yeah, he was a terrible man. He literally sold out the French defense plans and Belgium defense plans for the Maginot Line, which enabled the Nazis to do an end run. terrible guy.
What about Martin Bormann? I wonder if you've come across him.
Bormann was the guy that got the Western investors to back the Nazi Party. And he knew that what Hitler was doing was really ridiculously crazy to try and fight a war on both fronts. I remember reading the Nazi ambassador's top secret file record from Nuremberg, where he said it wasn't just Windsor, there was also Ramsay MacDonald was also not entirely unsympathetic to Nazi views. So there's a whole clique of very powerful people in Britain who were on the enemy side. And, you know, Windsor was actually saying to Hitler, go ahead and keep up the bombing on Britain. The people are about to break. And then my crowd will come in and, you know, you'll restore me as the first fascist king of England.
So he was hoping to come back.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, after he resigned, he was given a job with the military as a general to inspect, you know, defenses in Europe. And all he did was pass all the top secret French and British plans to Hitler.
If you could just sum up what you think, why you think this sort of thing is still important today.
Yeah, I think the notion is that the Israelis have a sense of being surrounded, not just by Arabs, but by the Western nations who will do anything for oil. And that, you know, as long as we are oil reliant, that Israel will be expendable to the price of oil. Now, both Britain and the United States are becoming, you know, more and more energy independent, and we're slowly making the trends towards getting rid of fossil fuel dependence entirely. But, you know, so the Zionists and the Israelis sometimes act crazy, and there's a reason for that. So you got to look at both sides. Yes, I do not like how some of the Palestinians are treated. I've been to Israel several times. But on the other hand, is, you know, the Arab states have, for years, made it illegal for a Jew to buy property, made it illegal for a Jew to worship in public. When the American forces went in to Saudi Arabia to help protect them from Saddam Hussein, the Jewish chaplains had to take the Star of David off their uniforms. So if they're paranoid, doesn't mean that they're not always out to get you. You know, there were reasons for this paranoia. And so they act a little crazy. Maybe they have a right to be a little crazy. But we need to understand what happened in order to end the craziness.
Okay, you know? So your book, Secret War Against the Jews, we've been talking a bit about some stuff from Chapter 7 of that, about Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah, I thought it was banned in Britain. I thought that no one could get a copy in Britain. There's no British publisher for it.
Well, I suppose you can get a copy sent across the Atlantic if you wish. But yep. What about some of your other books, John? Are there any other you'd like to plug that listeners might be interested in?
Yeah, sure. I did. The first book was called The Belarus Secret, and it's now, that was the one where I exposed on 60 Minutes that we had this clandestine support for Nazis from Eastern Europe who actually ended up working for the Cambridge Five and the British Intelligence Service. So they ended up betraying American secrets. And that was then nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in History. And, you know, it did pretty well. It's an updated version. It's called America's Nazi Secret. And then there's a book, you can only get it in Canada, called The Witness Tree. I did a novel about what really happened with the Rockefeller negotiations with Israel and why Eleanor Dulles betrayed her Nazi brothers and helped the Zionists create the State of Israel. So it's a fiction based on fact. And then I did Unholy Trinity, which was the Vatican, the Nazis, and the Swiss banks. You know, I'm Irish Catholic, but hey, look, the truth is that after the war, the Pope smuggled the Nazi money and the Nazi war criminals out of Europe using the Vatican as cover. Terrible. Absolutely terrible. But it happened. I had a little help. My Aunt Peggy was the head of the Order of Notre Dame nuns in Vatican, so she and her buddies helped my friends do a little research that other people haven't been able to accomplish. But basically, you know, for 40 years now, I've been a lawyer for whistleblowers from all of the NATO intelligence services who want to preserve history. And I go back and make sure the work is properly declassified. And I don't leak secrets. I don't give the names of spies or anything bad like that. But, you know, people are entitled to know the truth. They should be very angry at what some of our governments have done and demanded some accountability. Because the worst, believe me, the worst is yet to come out.
Well, that's John Loftus there speaking to me early this week, the author of A Secret War Against the Jews and several other books. Martin, he's really showing, I suppose, that even from before the war, people like the Dulles brothers were looking to make money out of the war and also to install some of their Nazi friends in powerful positions in the American intelligence after the war.
And of course, that's why we've had all this kind of horrendous psychological warfare operations, 9/11, etc., because basically the people behind them are Nazis, not to put too fine a point on it. Can I just mention that there's going to be a demonstration against war with Iran tomorrow, assembling at the fountains at 12 p.m.
You certainly can, here in the city centre. Yes, but it doesn't look as if there is actually going to be a war. It looks as if it's going to be a slow attrition of the Quds force by the Americans and Israelis. They're just going to continue every week or so or every few days killing some of these Iranians who they don't think should be in Iraq and Syria.
Well, in other words, there is a war. It's just going to be a slow war. And of course, it could easily at any moment go into a big one. We need to demonstrate.
Can you just give us your summary, though, of what you make of what John Loftus is saying there about the presence of Nazis right the way through in the United States? Because up until the U.S., I think was it Eisenhower that said this in his farewell speech? He said, "Well, actually, before World War II, there was no real permanent arms industry in the United States. It's only since then we've got to worry about this military-industrial complex, which could take over."
Well, it has taken over. That's exactly what's happened. And, of course, you know, Milton Friedman, the right-wing economist, said, well, once you create industries with, you know, government resources, they then become a vested interest to demand even more resources. And that's where most of the majority of US taxpayers' money, and, you know, they print dollars as well because they don't just have taxes, that's what it goes on, military expenditure.
Well,
this military expenditure isn't just for show. It ends up with lots of dead people.
Actually, what Alan Dulles was arguing for at the CIA was more money should go on intelligence than actually on military hardware.
Well, I mean, that you're going to have different fights. You know, the Navy always thinks they need more ships.
Okay. Well, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8 o'clock. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Hengrove and Whitchurch Park, Tim Kent. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car anywhere you like. This show's podcast, story links and comment pages this week, oneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable and war-free BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects on Tuesday at noon. Do join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week.